The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Well, this morning I would like to give some reflections about compassion. And before I directly address that, I'd like to make a point or say something that hopefully it's by saying it first, it's more memorable. And that is that a settled mind has room for anything. A reactive mind is too crowded to take anything else in. And so there's a famous Zen story that illustrates this of a university professor, maybe philosophy professor. I apologize for any professors or philosophy professors who might be here that sometimes for these stories they get stereotyped in a certain way. And but it could be anyone, but goes to see a Zen master to talk about Buddhism and learn about Buddhist philosophy and all that. And so they're having tea. And so the Zen master is serving tea, and the professor is holding his teacup to be served. The tea starts getting poured in, and when it gets to the top of the cup, the Zen master doesn't stop pouring. It fills up and starts spilling over the edge. And the professor says, it's full. I can't hold anymore. You should stop pouring in. And so the Zen master says, in the same way, you're so full of your opinions and ideas, there's no room in there to hear what I have to say. So a settled mind has room for anything. A reactive mind can be so crowded there's room for nothing. So a week ago we had the shootings in Orlando, the killings in Orlando, and they certainly had a big impact on me and on many people. And 2 days ago, in the morning, I went to the Tenderloin with my 18-year-old teenage son mostly to take him to the St. Anthony's Soup Kitchen. Every year, the chaplaincy program we do, the members go up to the Tenderloin to visit some of the different services offered there for the homeless as part of their training in chaplaincy. And this year, because my son is 18, I thought, I should show him this part of the world, see this. So I went along. And so we went up there and parked, and we're walking through the Tenderloin to get to the St. Anthony's Kitchen. And there was, I was a little bit surprised to find 9 o'clock in the morning, people sleeping on the sidewalk next to the cars parked there against the wall. And I know San Francisco has a lot of homeless, but I kind of didn't think they would just, like, series of them would just be sleeping right smack on the sidewalk as if, fully covered up with blankets. And I imagine that sleeping 9 o'clock in the morning, they probably were up late. Maybe they had to be in a situation like that, maybe to be safe or something. And I could feel my compassion, my care for them, and my concern for, San Francisco seems to have changed quite a bit since I used to live there. And I could feel a change when I was walking around. And then we went to St. Anthony's, and the first thing that happened was an orientation for us to be volunteers. And we heard all kinds of statistics about the Tenderloin. It's a 30-block area of San Francisco, probably some of the poorest parts of San Francisco, or the poorest, and with about 20,000 people known to live there. And there are no grocery stores in those 30 blocks. However, there's 192 liquor licenses. And so the idea of buying fresh produce, fresh fruit and stuff, is not really available easily in the Tenderloin because that's not the kind of service that's provided there. And And that many people live in what's called single residence occupancies that are about either 8 by 10 or 10 by 10 rooms with no bathrooms. They have bathrooms down the hall, they share with other people. Kitchen they might share in a central kitchen area. And the rents for these single resident occupancy is about $800 to $1,200. And that this, especially for the elderly who get Social Security in the Tenderloin, apparently the standard amount they get is $786 a month. Now some of those maybe have subsidized housing, but $886 out of, you know, with $800 rent doesn't leave much left over. So I could hear all this, and then we were told about the wave of different people, who immigrants mostly, who kind of make up the Tenderloin different times. And it was kind of touching for me. It felt a lot of compassion, a lot of caring for the people who come end up there and trying to figure out a life for themselves and find work. And some of them, we were told, quite a few people work, but they might have four jobs, you know, in the course of a week, just to kind of try to make ends meet, and minimum wage jobs and things. So I could feel a lot of compassion and care and concern about the situation right here, so close to where I live, and all, many of us live, and that this goes on. And kept wondering, how do people end up in the Tenderloin? Partly, I think, because it's the rent is, even though it's expensive, in one category, it's some of the cheapest rents in the Bay Area. So people gravitate there because they can afford to live there. So so then we went over to St. Anthony's to serve, and St. Anthony's Kitchen serves 2,400 people a day, lunch. And that's a lot of people to come through. We had about 3 hours to serve lunch. And they had a very efficient operation. And they get a lot of volunteers who come through. And our group was part of the team this time. And another team that had come that day was members of one of the more prestigious stockbroker brokerages in this country. And they had their name or their brokerage company on their T-shirts. And I was very glad they were volunteering. I was glad they were seeing this part of the society. It felt really important. And, you know, it made me happy to know. But the juxtaposition of somehow, I don't know, I didn't know what to do with the juxtaposition of. There's, you know, huge dining room with tables, and the people come in to be fed, and they sit down at the tables, and then the people who are helping volunteers will pick up trays of food and carry it to the people at the tables and serve them, put it down in front of them. And then when they finish eating, then the volunteer people, busers, come and take the trays away and clean the table so the next people can come in. And there's a constant stream of people coming through. And I think we started at 10, I think, and by at the first hour, hour and a half, there was it was for people who were elderly, above 59 years of age, and it was quite touching for me to see just the age of the people and coming through, and I still had some compassion for them. Before we started serving, they were sitting there and concerned about these. Many people, I think, were immigrants, elderly, poor, and this, you know, was, I don't know if it was the one meal of the day, but they're allowed to take extra in seconds and pack it away in little containers and bring them home so that they have food. One of the things I learned is that in San Francisco, there's no need to starve in San Francisco because there's lots of food services there. And you can go to St. Anthony's, to Glide, a variety of different places you can go. So starving is not a problem if you're sane enough to make it there. And then, so then we started serving them, and it was kind of, you know, and it was kind of fun, you know, to be in this very kind of efficient kind of, I don't know, conveyor belt's the right word, but system of standing in line, getting trays, bringing it to people, and there were people directing us, you go bring it there, bring it there to that person, and then if they wanted seconds, they had to hold up a ticket, and so you were directed to go to the people that person over there with a ticket. And then at some point I was switched over to be a busser. And that was also fun to go over there and pick up food and talk with people a little bit and chat with them. But what was interesting, and why I'm telling you the story, is that as I did this, as I was serving them, I stopped having compassion. What happened to my compassion? You know, I don't think I'm a particularly cruel person. You know, but what happened instead was I just had a lot of love, a lot of metta, a lot of, it was just a delight to serve and to offer and to, you know, it was nice, you know, to have this kind of love or metta, loving kindness be the forefront. The compassion just kind of went into the background. And I think that's appropriate, maybe. Because, you know, sometimes compassion is held up as a wonderful virtue in Buddhism, and I think it is wonderful. But not everyone wants to be on the receiving end of compassion. That can be kind of uncomfortable for some people. Sometimes it's life-saving, but, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I'm going to be compassionate towards you today. You know, that might not be needed, or it might be, sometimes it's very easy, shades over into a sense of separation, a sense of I'm going to be the helper and help you, and kind of pity, and compassion can come along with all kinds of unusual, unnecessary attitudes which make people uncomfortable. But also I think that, you know, to serve them out of compassion, I mean, I was there partly out of compassion, but if that wasn't, you know, to have that in the forefront, I think it was a richer relationship I had with them, because it was just love, just kind of kindness and joy and a sense of generosity. And, you know, I just thought that I was having a great time. You know, it was nice for me to be there and do this activity and going around and putting food on the table, and it was kind of very efficient and kind of fast, and it was kind of a nice thing to do. And then to meet all this, such a wide range of people, 2,400 people, in the course of the morning. I didn't see all of them, but it was just such a wide range of our society to see them and be with them and serve them, and people with wheelchairs and old people and immigrants and of all kinds, and people with families came. If you're a family, you can come in with during the early time with the elderly people, elders. And so there were pockets of families with kids, and there's a family section, and to bring the kids their food. And this idea of having this generosity or kindness or love in the forefront, it came with a feeling of freedom or ease, you know, and probably there wasn't really the time for compassion, because compassion got me there. And once you're doing it, once you're active, then there's no longer need for compassion, because you are serving, you're doing the best you can. And so love, you know, friendliness and kindness maybe take precedent. And this is, I think, you know, in thinking about compassion since that Friday, I wonder if sometimes compassion is much easier in distance, when we're removed, you know, from a distance, you know, hearing about the tenderloin, or, you know, seeing the people sleeping on the street. You know, I wasn't going to be involved in them. I just kind of passed them by and had kind of a broken heart to kind of see them there, but, you know, I wasn't going to do anything about it, because that, you know, just wasn't the time and place for me to get involved with waking them up and telling them it's 9 o'clock, you should get up, and, you know, the soup kitchen starting soon, and, you know, whatever. You know, it wasn't just, you walk by, right? That's kind of heartbreaking. But then to put the compassion into action, then it has a chance for love to operate, for generosity to operate. At least in Buddhism, that's part of the idea of compassion, is that compassion is the desire, is based on empathy, the desire to alleviate suffering, the desire to have suffering of any kind be alleviated. So if you're actually working to alleviate suffering and helping, then, you know, you're doing it. Maybe there's less need for active compassion. You can recede to the background. And something maybe, I don't know if it's more precious, but something more appropriate for the moment is love. And then we left St. Anthony's and out in the street again. And it was a different population on the street now, this time. There weren't that many, but instead of people sleeping on the street, there were people who probably didn't have the sanity of mind to make it into St. Anthony's. They probably wouldn't have been allowed in, is my guess. The first person we saw was a person who was somehow bouncing off walls and cars and going into the streets and waving his hands, picking up trash and throwing against walls and crossing the track, you know, clearly in his own world and just, you know, acting completely erratically, that, you know, I felt some concern that I'm probably not the right person to go and over to help because I probably wasn't safe to get involved. And then there were two other people like that, you know, just walking through San Francisco for 10 minutes. And now I came back to compassion. You know, I couldn't help. I wasn't going to help, but I certainly, it broke my heart again. Why are these people on the streets? Why aren't there more services and help? Who can help these people? You know, who helps? Who steps forward? Do they wait until they go to jail? Do they wait until there's a real problem and the police pick them up? Why are they out here? So compassion, I think of as a community emotion. It's an emotion or an attitude that arises in relationship to our community and to our people around us, our friends, our family. And we have hopefully a large community, and hopefully the world is our community. And so what happens far away in Florida or Syria or anywhere is our community as well, and is our settled mind that has space for anything. Is our mind settled enough to have space to hold the tragedies of Orlando, tragedies of Syria and Iraq and different places, the tragedies of the Tenderloin right here? And what does it mean to have a settled mind that can hold it, to be open to it? I think one of the ideas of a settled mind, and supposed to a reactive mind, is that there is no distress or anxiety when we open to the suffering, because the anxiety and despair close the mind, close the heart down. So, whereas a settled mind is able to stay open, it doesn't succumb to despair or to anger or to fear. And I think that's one of the reasons why some of us meditate, is to learn how to have the gift, the benefits of a settled mind, discover how to maintain a settled mind in the face of challenges in our lives. And realizing that a settled mind, because it can hold everything in it, is a much more responsive mind. It's a mind or heart that's able to be wiser or more caring or come from compassion and love. And if we do have compassion, the compassion itself doesn't get confused with anxiety, doesn't get confused with horrified compassion. Oh my God, this is terrible. But is able to see it in a clear way and hold it in a calm, open space, so there's a chance to respond and be open. And maybe there's a chance to cry. Settled minds cry, I think, you know, and so shootings in Orlando and deaths anywhere else. The image that, the kind of symbolic image I have in my mind of this world we live in, when we see the tragedies of it, is the world reflected in a teardrop. You know, the whole world is in our teardrop. And then, you know, so the idea of caring for people. So one more thing, reflection about this visit to St. Anthony, and that was curious for me, so I went with my son, my 18-year-old son, and, you know, he's still living at home, and just graduated from high school, and he has an injury that he needs surgery for, and so he's limping around, and we actually had to leave St. Anthony's a little early because we had to go so he could see the surgeon and go down there. So, you know, it's kind of a little background of him, who he is, what's happening. So at some point, I didn't see him anymore in the kitchen, in the dining area. And so I didn't worry particularly, but that maybe he'd figure out to sit down someplace because of his leg. He tires easily. But I didn't see him. But I kept looking, you know, where is he? Is he busing? Is he serving those trays? You know, where is he? He's nowhere to be seen. I looked in the lobby. He's not there. Where's my son? Fortunately, there was someone from IMC there, also who had been there going for a couple of years. And I said to him, have you seen my son? And he said, yes, he's in the kitchen cutting bread. And so I said, okay, good. But what was curious about this little event was that I didn't have primary responsibility for the people I was serving the meals to. It was my care and compassion and desire to serve that brought me there. But I had more primary responsibility for my son. So there was a difference between what's primary and what's, I don't know if it's secondary, I don't want to say secondary, but there's a difference between where the responsibility lies. And so, you know, there are differences in how we experience tragedies in this world, depending on where we have the most ability to respond, the most responsibility. So I think it makes some sense for people in this country to have a different reaction to 49 people being killed in Orlando versus hundreds of people killed, you know, in any given time in Syria. Both are heartbreaking. But, you know, where do we have different responsibility in different places, different ability to respond? And then we have the Tenderloin right here, in the, you know, just up the peninsula a few miles away. And, you know, do we have a greater responsibility there? We have homeless here. We have soup kitchens here in Redwood City. And we have a responsibility here. You know, I asked my son if he'd been to St. Anthony's here, and I think it's called St. Anthony's, right? The one in Redwood City. And apparently, he's visited once. And I said, "Oh, how many soup kitchens have you been to in a short life?" And he'd been to a few in the peninsula because, you know, in terms of responsibility, right? What our local, what we in eighth grade, he made a 10-minute documentary about hunger in Silicon Valley. And I learned about the hunger in Silicon Valley from him that I didn't know. There's a very high percentage of people in the Silicon Valley who go hungry every day. And, you know, you think of Silicon Valley as being wealthy, but there's a lot of poverty as well, tucked away. And so he made this documentary, and so he had this ability to respond, or his response was to do this documentary. And he went to soup kitchens and homeless encampments. I guess, I'm not sure that they're still active, but the Guadalupe River in San Jose. So our ability to respond, our sense of responsibility, you know, who's our family? My son was my family, so I was concerned with him a little bit more. The people in the soup kitchen in St. Anthony's were my family, my cousins maybe. You know, people in Orlando or family, people who were killed. And what's interesting about it, the shooting in Orlando, is what a great cross-section of society was touched by this. You know, there was so many different nexus of so many different populations. You know, certainly there was the LGBTQ community that... I know that for me, that I had been lulled into a little bit of, I don't know if the right word, complacency is the right word, but a little bit too much of a sense that, oh, things have changed so much. And, you know, at least, in, you know, it's now getting to be safe for them to be out in the, out in the world in public, and then to find out how easy it is, you know, that they can be targeted this way, and it's not so safe. It actually turns out there's lots of lack of safety for that community still. And so he kind of opens up to this wider world. And then this was Latino night at the dance club. And so we have this population of people from Latin America in this country who have their own challenges and difficulties and that we know about that are quite a bit in the news these days. And then we have the population of Florida and population of the United States where we're struggling with the issue of gun control. A huge divide where people maybe don't understand each other, the two sides of it. And how do we find common ground? What is this about? And then we have a presidential election that this, you know, taps into and affects. And then we have the religion of the shooter. And that has a, you know, is also up in the news these days. And you know, a few weeks ago, some of you were probably here a few weeks ago when the imam came and spoke. And he talked about, he's an American-born imam. And he said that he, right down in San Jose where he lives, he does not go into certain parts of town at night because he doesn't feel safe going there. And I was surprised to hear that he feels that in San Jose. And so that, you know, Orlando affects, you know, comes affects that. And so it goes, you know, on and on and on. And so, you know, I see what happens in Orlando is happening to my family. Maybe it's my second cousins. But, you know, what is my ability to respond? How do I meet it? And I think that part of it, hopefully, is we respond with compassion. Compassion is such a beautiful emotion. You know, the ability to kind of see other people, be in their shoes, understand them, understand the goodness of them, understand that they have hearts like us, they have minds like us that are capable of happiness and love and generosity and goodness. And to kind of tune into that and to feel how the goodness and love and of people get so easily squeezed or broken or hurt. And to then have compassion and have an open heart, a settled mind and an open heart that is able, in a settled mind, to kind of hold it in a very simple way. It doesn't have to be complicated. When we get too much involved in blame and too much involved in fear and too much involved in our own distress, our own discomfort with it, then I think it, you know, makes the mind too crowded for the simplicity of compassion, just to hold it and be with it. And simple compassion is so powerful. And then we, hopefully from that, we respond to this world in some way, whether we respond to our neighbor who's ill or whether we support some of our local communities in a variety of ways, or we are involved with supporting refugees in Syria or outside of Syria, all kinds of things. You know, we find what our heart wants to do. I'm not liable to go back to St. Anthony's anytime soon. I'm really glad I went, but that's not my calling. You know, I have other things to my calling and how I'm going to do things. But it felt a wonderful thing to do on Friday, and I feel somehow, in, I don't know if the right word is, I feel maybe enriched, or I feel like my experience of this world is fuller and richer having been there. And to allow this experience into my heart. I hope that I'm a better person because of it. I hope that because of what happened in Orlando, that I become a better person because of it. And one of the great ways of responding to tragedy is to see how can you use the impact it has on you so you can be a better person, to motivate you to do better in this world, to serve the world in whatever way you can. Because I think that we do ourselves a tremendous disservice if these suffering, the tragedies of the world, impacts us greatly and we're not changed by it. If after a few weeks we go back to what was before, or if we only succumb to our opinions, what should be done and who's to blame, you know, to actually spend time, how can I be a better person for this? How can this, the energy of this, the motivation, the impact it has, how can this motivate me to live better, fuller? And then, perhaps, your compassion can be converted into love. The love that's only possible when we're engaged and present and involved and do it part of the answer, not just sitting back and having just compassion from a distance. I think the world has tremendous need for our love. And how is it that what the world presents us can help us love more, or have more heart, more compassion, more generosity? And finally, my hope is that the wonderful attitude and feeling and motivation of compassion can be seen as a gift. It's a gift that we can give the world. So those are my thoughts. Now, do you have any comments or questions or things you'd like to bring up?
The talk brings to mind a conversation I had with actually a very reliable source recently, who told me that you had said that it's a reliable source.
Good. Wait, that way I can go back and ask the person too.
That you had said there's no word in Buddhism, I'm not exactly how this was said, but something like there's no word for Buddhism in Buddhism for forgiveness. And we spent a good deal of time exchanging thoughts on that, and this seems connected to what you were speaking about.
Yes. It doesn't seem to be in the ancient Buddhist languages any word that that translates directly into forgiveness. Some people take some words there and translate them as forgiveness. So you find some of the English translations, the word forgiveness is there. But, like for example, generally what it literally means in the text is to admit. So like confess or to admit what you've done rather than, you know, asking for forgiveness. And and then when the people respond, when the Buddha responds to someone who says, "I did this, I admit it," and the Buddha then but the translator will say the person asked for forgiveness, and then the Buddha they say that the Buddha does forgive, but he doesn't forgive. All he says is that it's really good that you admit this, admitting what you've done when you've done a transgression. Admitting it to someone who is wise, that you respect, is a way of changing what you've done and disavowing it so that you can do better in the future. So it's more like that. And now the reason why there's this, so it's kind of a little shocking for people in the West to hear that Buddhism has no good word for forgiveness. And but the reason is that there's a very world, a huge difference between religions which are based on theology, based on external deities, and religions which are based on the individual and the individual heart. And so when there's an external deity who has the ability to decide what happens after you die, which direction you're going to go, that's pretty important, you know, pretty big deal. So it's pretty important to get forgiveness from that person. And so forgiveness plays a really big part of theistic religions. But Buddhism doesn't have that kind of deity who's going to judge you and, you know, at the pearly gates or something. And so it's karma based rather than theistically based. And so karma has a very different understanding of how actions and move through us. And karma you have to live with and deal with and work with. You can't easily be forgiven for your karma. The karma is the momentum in your own heart, your psychology, that you have to kind of work with and refine and work for yourself. Admitting you've done something and disavowing it and apologizing is a very important part of changing the karmic stream. But no one else can change the karmic stream for you by offering you forgiveness. Whereas the karmic stream in theistic religions is somehow changed because this person has this power to grant you something. So this is not exactly, maybe I haven't been so eloquent this morning about this, but there's a, this is, so Buddhism has a whole different, very different relationship to certain issues than we're used to here in the West and we expect here in the West, because Western discussion and language has arisen out of theistic religions. And one of the remnants of that is the word forgiveness. And it has strong associations, comes out of, I think, Christianity and Judaism, things like that. So it seems very important. It's a beautiful act to offer forgiveness or ask for forgiveness. I don't want to belittle it, but it just, in Buddhism, it's not something that's particularly emphasized. But there's comparable things which are emphasized. You're not supposed to just go around and say, oh, well, you know. You know, oh, well, and I just, you know, killed my neighbor, you know. So, again, you know, there are serious ways of, you know, processing that. Does that respond?
Hi, Gil. You talked about compassion, and the way you described it, it seemed to go unidirectionally. And I was wondering if you experienced compassion coming back toward you. And that raises another question in my mind as to what is this sense of connection that people feel with each other? It seems mutual at times. Is that two-way compassion? Is it love going in both directions?
There can be love going both directions. Compassion. I've experienced compassion going when I've been in conflict with someone else who was also a practitioner, and both of us were equally caring for the other person in the conflict. You know, caring for the other person and wishing to. So, in terms of forgiveness. I was at a series of meetings many years ago where we were trying to work through a very document that was, oddly enough, it was a document on ethics and how to deal with ethical, you know, procedures in the Buddhist community. And it's a very, very charged issue. So we were kind of really trying to get the document just right, endless meetings where the comma should go and, you know, to get the wording just right. And so there was plenty of, you know, room for little disagreements and stuff and duking it out. And so with one other person, we ended in one of the meetings kind of a little bit at odds with each other and a little tense because we had different ideas. And so the next time we met, a week later for the next meeting, I was ready, as soon as I saw this person, to apologize. Not forgiveness, but just apologize, I guess. But for my role in the, whatever was going on. But I didn't get a chance to be the first because he said first to me. He apologized for himself. So this idea of, you know, both apologizing, both kind of caring for each other, having a mutual. At St. Anthony's, I didn't feel any compassion coming towards me from the people I was serving. Some of them, you know, I was kind of, I didn't get any sense that they only, sometimes I was just kind of part of the background for them and they were interested in their food. But some of them clearly were, it was a mutual thing because sometimes when I was busing, sometimes they would get up and bring their tray to my little bus tray and, you know, give it to me rather than have me to get up and go reach over the table to get it. or they would thank me, or you know, they would try to make it a little easier. So there was a sense that, that, you know, they were caring for me as well. Yes.
Hi. I loved what you said about compassion sort of fading into the background the more you helped people. And I resonated a lot with that because it's something I've always felt really bad about. I'm in a profession where I have to serve a lot of people. And when I read about them before I meet them, I feel the sense of, oh, this poor guy, look what they've lived with. Oh, this is terrible. And then I go in and I meet them and I talk to them some more. And the compassion really does fade away and it turns into something else where I'm like, oh, this is a problem. This is a series of things I have to fix. I have to work the problem. And then the compassion does fade away. And I'm not sure if it's replaced with love, but it's replaced with concentration and work and investment. And I've always felt terrible about it because I always wanted to carry that compassion through me in that interaction so that they feel it, because that's what I'm supposed to feel. So thank you very much.
Yeah, I think it's appropriate if you're professionally trying to focus and do something to really focus on that, and you're doing something important and at that time. So in the bigger picture, you have compassion. It's there in the background. But what's called for the moment is that focus and problem solving. Hopefully, that what doesn't recede in the background is respect for them. And so they hopefully, I don't know what you do, but I think that people feeling respect is very important.
I think there have been times, not so much now, but there have been times in, you know, during my training where the, actually had a test about this yesterday, where you do actually start to lose respect the more overwhelmed you get and the more people that you have to see and the more problems you have to solve. And the test actually asked us that, you know, when you're feeling overworked, what's the first thing to go? And it's not inability to solve problems, it's compassion. And that was E. I circled that one. Yeah.
So remember, a settled mind has room for anything. So to train oneself, to practice and learn mindfulness, learn to meditation, so that you can learn how to stay settled in often challenging, busy situations is one of the great things to do. And if you do that, then some of the best qualities of you are going to be available. But if you're overwhelmed, then it's hard for those good qualities to come out. So one more. Yeah, I saw Bruni here.
So in reflecting on that settled mind, open heart, for individuals, is it through the Brahmaviharas that then mindfulness of a community as a collective can be manifested? I've been reflecting about the four states of mindfulness collectively.
Yes. So I think what you're asking is that when we practice mindfulness, can we have mindfulness not just for ourselves but also for our community around us? Is that what you're saying? Does it then manifested or as one of the four forms of love?
Yes, and so how it is seen? Because I see it like in the West, we practice mindfulness, and then there's like maybe a stop of just practicing individually or just within ourselves. What it takes to take it out more into the world collectively?
Yeah. So I'm not sure what to say, but yes, I think that something like meditation practice, because it's something, you know, we close our eyes, it can be done solitarily. You know, in a sense, the focus is on one's own inner process and settling and all that. That it can lend itself to being overly self-preoccupied, and at certain phases of people's lives, that can be quite appropriate to do that. When you go into the bathroom to do whatever you do there, the shower or whatever, I think it's okay to be self-preoccupied during that time. And so there are phases of meditation practice where you kind of go and retreat or do something. But I think to get the most out of it, it's also important to be able to open the capacity for mindfulness and pay attention to the world around us, to our the people around us, and be mindful of them. And it takes the form of listening well. So mindfulness of others, listen to them carefully and be willing to listen. Take time to hear what they're going on. For the world, wider world, I think it's important to be a witness to what goes on in our world. So in the way that it works for you, to spend some time with the news and find out what's going on locally and really understand. I think that becomes a way that mindfulness can be completely, have no barriers to it or no limitations to it. The blinders are off. And so the mindfulness is 360 degrees. It's just available for whatever. And it turns out as mindfulness practice goes deeper into oneself, like silent meditation, one of the effects of deeper meditation is that the boundaries between self and others begin to soften, maybe disappear sometimes. And as those boundaries soften, it's natural then to have the direction of our seeing be both external and internal equally. There's no particular reason why a mindfulness practitioner would focus more on themselves than for others. Because as the mind gets freer, there's no boundaries, there's no limitations for what direction the mindfulness can go. And so it goes wherever is most compelling, whatever is the greatest need of the time. And sometimes the greatest need is here with oneself. Sometimes it's natural to bring it out into the world. Great. Well, thank you all very much. And may you all have a settled mind and a generous heart. Thank you.